Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
Our broadcast today is brought to you by NatureBox, customizable, delicious, healthier snacks that are delivered right to your door. And 50% off your first box right now at naturebox.com/thinkingatheist. So like many of you, I've been following the Ark encounter. This replica of Noah's Ark that Ken Ham is building in Kentucky. It's just sad to see it all happen like this. You know, he's pitching it as this. I'm sure he's going to be pitching it like he pitches the Noah's Ark exhibit in the Creation Museum. This will demonstrate the hard fact, the scientific truth of the Genesis account. Yes, long ago, man's sin caused God to flood the world, and yet one family and animals two by two were saved and charged to repopulate the earth. Here, kids, this is fact. And this will be that on a grand scale. And so I've been kind of following the story along with many of you. I'll tell you some people who have been really following the story. Ed and Michael Hensley in Kentucky, they're wired in with the Kentucky Secular Society, done a lot of writing and research on this. And then Dan Errol, he's a journalist and author of the book Parenting Without God, has done quite a bit of blogging on this. Researching a lot of the, let's face it, kind of scary and shady tactics going on to try to secure taxpayer money to make this religious icon a reality. We're going to talk to Ed and Michael and Dan next Tuesday on a show I'm simply calling Noah's Lark. And again, that'll be Tuesday of next week. In a couple of weeks, I'm talking to Dan Barker. He's hot off the release of a new book called God, the Most Unpleasant Character in All Fiction. And of course, that's a play on the classic Dawkins quote from The God Delusion back in 2007. We're going to talk about all this unpleasantness in relation to God. What's that about? That's coming up 2 weeks from tonight. And in 3 weeks, Dr. Harriet Hall of Science-Based Medicine and Dr. Stephen Barrett of Quack Watch will join me as we have some actual scientists on the show to talk about alternative medicine. Actually, I've titled the show Evil Western Medicine, which is normally what I hear. And that actually kind of ties into the show we've been doing over the past couple of weeks, and we're continuing tonight on medical neglect. These are people, in many cases, who reject science-based solutions because somebody sold them pie in the sky. And whether it's prayer or homeopathy, we're talking about stuff that's not necessarily rooted in reality, certainly not rooted in the evidence. And in just a second here, I'm going to be speaking with Dr. Paul Offit about medical neglect, about medicine, about science, about prayer, and about the harm done by those who reject evidence-based claims in regard to their own health care and that of their children. So hang on for that. It's going to be a compelling exchange. Real quick, though, I want to say a huge thank you out to our show sponsor for the broadcast tonight. NatureBox has been with me for a while. You know, I logged on to NatureBox's homepage to fill up my online pantry, and they know enough about me and what I like that they've already made some recommendations on the page. The recommendations included the sweet kettle crunch, the dark cocoa almonds, the white cheddar, caramel popcorn, and they pretty much have my number. They know what I like, with over 100 healthier snack options and new options added every single month, all made with zero artificial colors, flavors, or sweeteners. NatureBox has given me a customizable way to snack smarter. And they've done the same for many of our listeners as well. It's already February of the new year, but it is never too late to ditch the junk food and enjoy something that's just better, NatureBox. And right now, your first box, 50% off when you log on to naturebox.com/thinkingatheist. Try them out and see why I and so many of our listeners just love this stuff. naturebox.com/thinkingatheist. There was an article a few years ago in Wired titled How Panicked Parents Skipping Shots Endanger Us All. And the article mentions my guest on the show tonight. I'll just read a portion of the article. It says this. To hear his enemies talk, you might think Paul Offit is the most hated man in America. A pediatrician in Philadelphia, he is the co-inventor of a rotavirus vaccine that could save tens of thousands of lives every year. Yet environmental activist Robert F. Kennedy Jr. slams Offit as a biostitute who whores for the pharmaceutical industry. Actor Jim Carrey calls him a profiteer and distills the doctor's attitude toward childhood vaccination down to this chilling mantra, grab 'em and stab 'em. Carrey and his girlfriend, Jenny McCarthy, and again, they've broken up since then, this is an older article, went on CNN's Larry King Live and singled out Offit's vaccine, Rotatec, as one of the many unnecessary vaccines, all administered, they said, for just one reason, greed. Thousands of people revile Offit publicly at rallies, on websites, and in books. Type pauloffit.com into your browser, and you'll find not Offit's official site, but an anti-Offit screed, quote, dedicated to exposing the truth about the vaccine industry's most well-paid spokesperson. Go to Wikipedia to read his bio, and as often as not, someone will have tampered with the page. The section on Offit's education was once altered to say that he'd studied on a pig farm in Toad Suck, Arkansas. He is, of course, a graduate of Tufts University and the University of Maryland School of Medicine. Then there are the threats. Offit once got an email from a Seattle man that read, "I will hang you by your neck until you are dead." Other bracing messages include, "You have blood on your hands," and "Your day of reckoning will come." A few years ago, a man on the phone ominously told Offit he knew where the doctor's two children went to school. At a meeting of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, an anti-vaccine protester emerged from a crowd of people holding signs that featured Offit's face emblazoned with the word terrorist and grabbed the unsuspecting 6-foot-tall physician by the jacket. "I don't think he wanted to hurt me," Offit recalls. "He was just excited to be close to the personification of such evil." Still, whether Offit gets a letter with an unfamiliar return address, he holds the envelope at arm's length before gingerly tearing it open. "I think about it," he admits. Anthrax. So what has this award-winning 58-year-old scientist done to elicit such venom? Let's see, I don't know how many years ago this was written. So he's in his 60s. He boldly states in speeches, in journal articles, and in his 2008 book, Autism's False Prophets, that vaccines do not cause autism or autoimmune disease or any of the other chronic conditions that have been blamed on them. He supports this assertion with meticulous evidence. And he calls to account those who promote bogus treatments for autism, treatments that he says not only don't work, but often cause harm. As a result, Offit has become the main target of a grassroots movement that opposes the systematic vaccination of children and the laws that require it. McCarthy, an actress and a former Playboy centerfold whose son has been diagnosed with autism, is the best-known leader of the movement, but she is joined by legions of well-organized supporters and sympathizers. This isn't a religious dispute like the debate over creationism and intelligent design. It's a challenge to traditional science that crosses party, class, and religious lines. It is partly a reaction to Big Pharma's blunders and PR missteps. From Vioxx to illegal marketing ploys which have encouraged a distrust of experts. It is also ironically a product of the era of instant communication and easy access to information. The doubters and deniers are empowered by the internet. Online, nobody knows you're not a doctor. And helped by the mainstream media, which has an interest in pumping up bad science to create a debate where there should be none. In the center of the fray is Paul Offit. Quote, "People describe me as a vaccine advocate," he says. "I see myself as a science advocate." But in this battle, and make no mistake, he says it's a pitched and heated battle. Science alone isn't enough. People are getting hurt. Well, tonight we're going to spend some time in conversation with the subject of this article, Dr. Paul Offit. We're going to talk about vaccines and a whole lot more on this second part of our Medical Neglect in the Name of God series. Dr. Paul Offit is director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, as well as the Maurice R. Hilleman Professor of Vaccinology and a professor of pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. He has received awards for his work from the University of Maryland, the Infectious Disease Society of America, the National Institutes of Health, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and much more. And he was elected to the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences in 2011. An author of over 150 scientific papers, Dr. Offit is the co-inventor of the rotavirus vaccine, Rotatec. And he released his book, Bad Faith, When Religious Belief Undermines Modern Medicine. And that book was selected as an editor's choice by the New York Times in April of 2015. Dr. Paul Offit, thank you so much for joining me on the radio.
Thank you.
Let's start with vaccines. Even in the free thought movement, even among atheists, we sometimes hear people say vaccines cause autism. Can you address the vaccine question for us?
Sure. I think asking the question is fine. I mean, from the parent standpoint, my child was fine. Then they got a vaccine or a series of vaccines. And then within a month or so, they developed signs and symptoms that were consistent with autism. Could the vaccine have done it? The good news is that's an answerable question. I mean, you're not asking how many angels can dance on the head of a pin here. You're asking a scientific question that can be answered in a scientific venue and has been. I mean, this now vaccines autism issue has gone through several iterations. The first was the concern that the combination measles, mumps, rubella, or MMR vaccine caused autism. There are now about 14 studies that have shown you're at no greater risk of getting autism if you got that vaccine or if you didn't. Then it sort of morphed to thimerosal, this ethyl mercury-containing preservative that was in vaccines that were given to young children could cause autism, and that too has been done. About seven studies have looked at that question, all found the same thing, which is thimerosal vaccines didn't cause autism. And then more recently, it's this sort of vaguer, too many vaccines given too soon is somehow causing autism. That too has been addressed by two studies. In fact, that's what came up most recently at one of the Republican national presidential debates. Both Carson and Trump brought that up, and that too has been answered. So it doesn't bother me that people ask the question. What I guess upsets me in this is that when answers are clear, that they then don't believe those answers.
We're also living in a culture where people are getting their medicine from celebrities.
Well, Jenny McCarthy is my personal go-to person for healthcare advice, so absent her, though. No, I'm just kidding. No, I think, you know, celebrities are given a platform. We see them on the bigger little screen. We think we know them, and we trust them. That's why they sell products. And most celebrities, I think, use that platform for the good. I think that some don't. Some of them air their just most ill-founded notions about science or medicine, and they're given a platform, and so we listen to them. Hopefully, most people aren't paying attention to them, but you're right, they have an impact.
Let's talk about faith. Let's talk about faith as to whether or not it has merit in helping people navigate through health challenges in their lives. Are you, may I ask, a person of faith?
No. Both my parents are Jewish and conservative. Me and my brother and sister and I were raised as that. My brother and sister are actually both now very observant Jews. My sister lives in an Orthodox Jewish community or attends an Orthodox Jewish synagogue in London. My brother lives outside New York and is also very religious, but not me. I just by the time I was 13 or 14, I just didn't believe in the existence of a supreme being. So it just was hard for me to go to synagogue and pray to something that I didn't believe existed. And as time went on and I was no longer in my parents' home, it was much easier to do that. I'm basically a non-theist.
In the book Bad Faith, you don't take a really hard line with people of faith or people who hold to a particular religious belief, and you cite instances in scriptures where it's positive, where it's helpful. Well, it says we should love one another and we should help and be charitable, those types of things. That was a conscious thing at the beginning of the book, correct?
Correct. I mean, I show, and it's only a number of people, including two people from New York Times, sort of criticized, or one person in New York Times criticized me for this. I think one can choose to interpret religion as one pleases at some level. I chose a benign interpretation, which is that religion teaches us to care about our children and care about our community and care about our family. And so when people then hurt their children in the name of God, in the case of the book Bad Faith, then I think that's a profoundly unreligious act and shouldn't be given the legal protections of religion.
The point may have been that certain portions of certain religions say we should love and we should be charitable and we should help. If you were to go through and actually examine other scriptures, it wouldn't be quite so charitable. You know, I think that's the larger point that maybe some are trying to make is, there are certainly some lovely verses inside the books of the Bible and even the Quran or elsewhere. But if we were to take it as the totality of the book, you know, the entire thing, we were to take it literally, we would have to sort of step over some very uncomfortable things. And when it comes to religion, we get into the reliance upon a religious solution to often real world problems. Let's start with Christian Science and a story of Rita Swan, who's actually a part of this broadcast. You call Christian Science a cult?
Yes. I think the answer to that question is yes. I guess the question is how one defines cult. I mean, you could argue that cults are anything that any religion that's less than 1,000 years old. But what I would say more reasonably is that I would define cult as a religion which makes an attempt to really restrict information. And that was Christian Science. I mean, Christian scientists, and Rita Swan was one example, will tell you that, you know, they're told specifically, don't watch television shows or read magazine or newspaper articles regarding medicine because, you know, it's sort of the devil's work, essentially. And so they try and restrict information. They restrict free thought. And I think that therein danger lies. So to me, that's a cult.
The Christian scientists, like the Jehovah's Witnesses, they won't do blood transfusions. They won't do they not do any medical solutions? They don't do any doctor visits, no hospital visits, no emergency room, nothing?
Well, Mary Baker Eddy, really associated with some lawsuits that she faced, does allow certain medical things to be done. So, Mary, you know, she wore glasses. So Christian scientists are allowed to wear glasses. You know, they're allowed to set broken bones. So they're allowed to get obstetrical care. But that's pretty much it. They're allowed to take pain medicines, interestingly, because she did. So there are certain things they allow. But for the most part, they believe that that God is perfect, that God created man in his image, and therefore man is perfect. So, for example, if you see a boil on the back of your hand, that boil actually doesn't exist. It's not so much that she believed in mind over matter, which was more Freudian and came later. She didn't believe in matter. I mean, that boil didn't exist, and therefore the reason you perceive it to exist is you're not close enough to God, so you need to get closer to God, and as you get closer to God, then the boil disappears. So, no, for the most part, they don't believe in any medical care. Jehovah's Witnesses believe in medical or get medical care. Their one thing is that they don't get blood transfusions.
If a Christian Science parent decides no medical treatment, no vaccines, no nothing for my child, is this child abuse?
Yes, I think it's certainly at least child neglect, and that borders on child abuse. I mean, first of all, that's actually gone to this, at least part of that's gone to the Supreme Court twice. If a child comes into our hospital and needs a blood transfusion, and the parents are Jehovah's Witnesses and say this is against our faith, we can get a court order in an hour, make the child a ward of the state, and give them a life-saving blood transfusion. Vaccines are different, because vaccines, it's more of a statistical thing. If you choose not to get a vaccine, the odds are you're not going to die. You might, but the odds are much less than if you, say, for example, need a critical blood transfusion. So there they're allowed to do that. I mean, you know, 47 states have religious exemptions to vaccination, and only three don't.
We're talking a lot in this broadcast about the natural cure, getting your body in tune with nature, getting your vibrations right. You know, if you submit yourself to evil Western medicine, you are poisoning your body with these quote-unquote healing agents of, you know, science. And it's better to go over here to talk to the guy who's sitting, you know, in the corner on the carpet surrounded by incense, who has no medical training whatsoever, who tells you that chakras and crystals and, you know, acupuncture meridians and whatnot, those are the real chess pieces in this game. You deal a lot with the alternative healers and alternative medicine?
Yes, we deal with it in our hospital. We deal with it with people who practice in this hospital. At some level, I don't have a problem with it. I think that, so for example, I mean, in this hospital, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, we have a chaplain. And so she will come to the bedside of people who request that, and she will pray for you. Now I would argue that that the people for whom she prays aren't specifically getting healing from God as compared to those for whom she doesn't pray. I don't think that's true. But I do think that when there's prayer, I think it relaxes the family. It may well relax the patient. You could argue that there's a physiology to that as you're relaxed, you know, you don't release mediators of stress, which can affect your immune system, which can affect your blood pressure. So I think I have no problem with that. I feel the same way in some ways about homeopathy, which is basically like giving somebody nothing, but they, you know, they're believing that they're getting something. And so there can be, I think there's a physiology to placebo pain relief, which is all studyable and has at some level been studied. What bothers me is when you sort of cross the line. I think you cross the line when you do things like, one, charge a lot of money for it. I think that's not fair. Or two, that you substitute it for in place of something that actually can do good. You know what I mean? So don't do prayer instead of chemotherapy or instead of antibiotics for meningitis. So I think there you cross the line. And of course, it's a very slippery slope because you're basically promoting something that's not scientific. And, you know, once you do that, you enter a dangerous world.
Well, as a man of science, if you see someone doing something that may give comfort, you know, it does produce a positive feeling. It relaxes the patient. It reduces stress. Does the question, is it true, play into it at all? I mean, is it okay to embrace a happy fantasy if I feel emotionally better while I'm trying to recover?
Yeah, no, I think it's, as a man of science, I would say there's a science to it. You know, there are studies done looking, for example, at people who get pain relief from acupuncture, and you can find that they have learned to release their own endorphins, you know, which are, you know, these pain-mediating chemicals that our own body makes, the so-called morphine-like chemicals. So they can do that, and that's great. It's nothing to do with putting the needles under the skin. It has nothing to do with where you put the needles, and those studies have been done. You can use retractable needles, and they'll get the same effect. So my attitude on these things is these are studyable situations, so they should be studied, and we should find out the least burdensome, least expensive way to, in this case, reduce what is a pain relief that we're learning. And this is from back from the days of Norman Cousins when he wrote *In the Anatomy of an Illness*. I think he felt better because of this, that he believed that that emotionally he can create a physiology that helps him, and I think that's all true. I just, what bothers me in this is when people sort of look to the gods to try and explain it. You don't have to do that. I think you can look to science to explain these things. And you alluded to something earlier, the sort of Western medicine, Eastern medicine paradigm, or alternative medicine, or integrative medicine, or complementary, or holistic medicine. I think it's all nonsense. I mean, you know, medicine's medicine. If an alternative medicine, for example, works, then it's medicine. If an alternative medicine doesn't work, then it's not an alternative. It's all understandable. And in large part, we haven't understood it, but I think it is understandable.
Talking here with Dr. Paul Offit, who is author of the book Bad Faith, When Religious Beliefs Undermine Modern Medicine, among others. Let's talk about Western medicine versus Eastern medicine. I hear this in water cooler conversation all the time. West bad, East good. They practice the same science-based medicine in the East that they do here, do they not?
Yes, they do.
Heart surgery is the same in China as it is in the United States, correct?
I think there's probably more a so-called, quote-unquote, Eastern medicine or alternative medicine practice here than there is in China. There's probably more acupuncture done here than in China. I think it's perfectly possible.
They've been doing this in Asia for thousands of years. Seems to be a selling point. It's old and they've done it a long time. You hear this quite a bit?
Yes, I think at the heart of it, it's that we are obviously a very much a technological civilization at the moment. We've evolved to have a lot of technology, and with that, we live much longer. I mean, we live 30 years longer than we did 100 years ago because of that technology, because of antibiotics, because of vaccines, because of sanitation programs, because of lesser smoking. I mean, that's why we live longer. But because we live longer lives doesn't mean that we're necessarily living more fulfilled lives. And so the technology can't provide that. I mean, they don't provide essentially a context. They just allow you to live longer. So I think people feel that they've lost something in that, lost something in this sort of more technological age. And so there's this notion that in the past that wasn't true, that we could, you know, that there's something Eastern and ephemeral and that sort of this ancient wisdom, which to me, frankly, is a contradiction in terms. I mean, you know, medicine evolves. We learn more as we go. I think ancient wisdom is just seems a little, in the world of science, medicine seems a little contradictory. There's a New Yorker cartoon, which I think perfectly summarizes it. You have two cavemen sitting around a fire. One looks to the other and says, I don't get it. You know, all our air is pure. All our water is clean. All our animals are free range and nobody lives past 30.
I want to come back to the placebo effect. I was talking to Dr. Andy Thompson, who's a psychiatrist and author, who was talking about how the placebo effect, in the past at least, has been sort of poo-pooed by many people. Oh, it's just the placebo effect you're feeling. But now many people in medical science are beginning to embrace the placebo effect as a valid health benefit in some cases. Hey, you're getting an effect. A physiological effect is taking place in the body.
Yes, and I think that's fair. I think that's exactly right. The term placebo, I think, has a dismissive tone, and it shouldn't be this. First of all, know that conventional practitioners all practice placebo medicine. I mean, you know, we wear the white coat with the red stenciling. When we hand somebody a medicine, we often say, I think this is going to work for you. That matters. That makes a difference. You know, we have these big machines that make interesting and loud noises. When you walk into the hospital, you walk into a place where you're expecting there to be essentially a therapeutic response. So I do think we all at some level play into that, which is fine. I think that's great. And I think now there are studies, and so what used to be called the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine is now devoting much more of its money to understanding the physiology of in this, in one instance, pain relief. And I think that's all great. I think that's just great. I just think you have to be careful that you don't cross the line into voodoo, which is, you know, what is a little frightening.
Well, that's my next question. I mean, how do you create an atmosphere where the placebo effect is being cultivated without lying to the patient?
Well, I think you do lie to the patient at some level. And I think if it's low burden and low cost and low risk, I think that is an ethical thing to know. This, we do it all the time. Honestly, when I walk into a room and I explain to parents and the family about a certain disease, I will, in, let's say, the case of bacterial meningitis, where I know the child was diagnosed early, I know what bacteria is causing it, I know what antibiotic that child's getting it, and I know that there's a very good chance that that child is going to survive and do well. I'll say that to the parent. I'll say, I really, you know, I'm very optimistic that this is going to have a good outcome. That matters. It really does matter. It relaxes people. I think it has an effect on the parent and the child. So we all do that. I think that's fine.
Well, that's not a lie, though, if you're accurately representing the scenario in question.
But you don't know for sure. You know, you don't know for sure. And when you give somebody medicine and you say, I'm really, I think this is really going to work for you, you know it's probably going to work for them. But in part, you're selling it a little bit because that matters. It's not an outright lie, but it's a, you know, you're representing something that you're not absolutely certain of. There are no certainties in medicine.
I always wondered if physicians would rather err on the side of caution. It'd be like the emergency room physician and somebody's in some sort of a very critical surgical procedure after an accident, and they don't know if they're going to make it. Instead of coming in and giving false hope, they'd actually say something like, we just don't know. I mean, they won't give false hope when they realize that, you know, he's really on the razor's edge kind of thing. I always wondered if doctors would actually sort of slide the other direction just to be safe.
And do. And in some ways, and I think this is actually the worst case scenario, is they, you know, you set yourself up as godlike, you know, that there is, you know, this really looks grim, and then you come in to save the day. So that happens too. But, you know, I think people are generally cautious in medicine, so they're sort of loath to do that. But again, think about how anxiety-provoking that is when you say to families, you know, boy, this is
At some point, it's just cruelty, right? If you offer too much information and you're too dark at the very beginning of the conversation, you're just piling on misery on top of misery. I understand that.
I think that's right. I think it just makes it worse.
What are your largest criticisms of science-based medicine? What are the pitfalls? What are the problems? What are the things that drive you crazy?
Well, the notion that all relief can be found with a prescription. You know, the I think we really play into the notion that here's a that we know that the patient or the parent wants a prescription. They want to believe that all ills can be lessened by a magic medicine. I think it's the old line is that in the past all our magic looked like medicine. Now currently all our medicine looks like magic, and so we're very quick to write a prescription. So we definitely overprescribe. So, I mean, whether it's antibiotics for, you know, what are viral upper respiratory tract infections or viral, you know, other viral diseases, you know, I think because we know that we're playing into the hands of people who we know want that prescription. I think we also have sort of very quick to characterize things as a disorder that requires a medicine. So there's a book called The Death of Sadness, which sort of makes the point that there are no moods anymore, that everything's an affective disorder that requires treatment. So I think we overtreat. I think that's absolutely true. In some ways, when Mehmet Oz says, you know, when our children are sick, my wife gives them homeopathic arnica, and if they continue to be sick, then she calls me. At some level, that's not a bad idea, because I think what happens is homeopathic arnica is nothing, and probably for what is probably a viral infection, which is going to be made better with time, and if it is a bacterial infection, then it's going to become more evident, and so then they come to him. I think that's actually not the bad idea.
You brought up Dr. Oz. Let's talk about doctors on television, right? Daytime, morning television. They wear the scrubs. They've got the stethoscope. They've got the polish. They've got the soap opera good looks. And they are giving medical advice on national television. What's your take on TV physicians?
Well, I think Dr. Oz actually is the most disappointing to me, in the sense that he's brilliant. I mean, here's a guy who when he went to our medical school, he went to the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine, which is where I teach, and he also went to Wharton, interestingly, met his wife who was here in the Brynathyn community, which is sort of this big alternative type medicine community in suburban Philadelphia. And then he goes to Columbia, he rises through the ranks and becomes a, you know, professor of cardiovascular surgery. I mean, he does heart operations. I mean, he holds people's hearts in their hands and he fixes them. One could argue that modern medicine has, you know, and that's about as far as one can go in terms of using technology to practice healthcare. Yet he goes on TV and with the light shining on him, just proceeds to say a series of things that are just wrong. You know, he's the big promoter of the magic pill, for which he actually was brought to task in front of a congressional hearing not too long ago. But I just think it was a huge lost opportunity. And it's, you know, how many, he has millions of people watching that show. He has great graphics, you know, these wonderful graphics showing. And initially in the first couple of weeks, he talked about heart attacks and he talked about strokes and the things that really do hurt you. And I thought really used his platform to educate. And then he just descended into this netherworld of magic that I think really hurts people. So he shows people getting, you know, intravenous vitamins, you know, to make them better. And that's dangerous. That's a dangerous thing to do.
Didn't a number of prominent physicians come together and publicly call him out and ask for his dismissal from Columbia University?
Yes, they did. I think that was a mistake, actually. I think censoring people is never a good idea. I do think it's right to call him to task for the things he says, and you would like to believe in a better world, a world, by the way, in which we don't live, that, you know, that the people who run that show would actually care about, you know, trying to give good medical advice. They don't. They just care about giving interesting and in some ways fantastic, you know, fantastical medical advice.
Doesn't it speak to credibility, though? I mean, if he's, you know, he's a representative of Columbia. He's supposed to be a representative of science-based medicine, yet he is not. Is it a black eye for Columbia to keep him on staff, is my question.
I think it is. Yeah, I think it is. But I do think, and I think in a better world, those who, but Columbia, it's not, they're all Columbia, there are also groups at Columbia that treat, you know, chronic Lyme disease as if that's a real disease. It's not just Mehmet Oz. I mean, and it's not just Columbia University. I mean, there are, you know, Jefferson, which is an excellent university medical center here in our city, you know, practices holistic and integrative medicine, and Children's Hospital of Philadelphia is starting to do some of those things now, too. So it's sadly a marketplace. I think that that hospitals, instead of holding sort of their staff to a high bar of professionalism and a high bar of medical standard, I think many have descended into this sort of, we are going to cater to a marketplace and give people the things that they want. And I think that's a failure on our part.
I had somebody bring up on my Facebook page the story of Steve Jobs, right? A very intelligent guy who may have at least had a prolonged life had he not at the last second sort of rejected science-based solutions in favor of promises given by people with really no qualifications whatsoever.
No, exactly. He had a pancreatic tumor, and so people assume pancreatic tumors mean death, but he had actually, he didn't have your typical pancreatic tumor, which is to say an adenocarcinoma. He had a neuroendocrine tumor, which is, frankly, with early surgery, very amenable to treatment. I mean, 95% of people with early surgery with that kind of pancreatic tumor do survive and do well. He didn't want that. He chose, you know, things like coffee enemas and fruit juices and vegetable juices and acupuncture, and ultimately he delayed what was would have been a life-saving therapy, likely have been a life-saving therapy. So, see, that's the downside of internet access.
How much of what you do is a business? You know, the business of medicine, billions of dollars going back and forth, which is, of course, playing into the criticisms of Western, quote-unquote Western medicine or science-based medicine. Why would it need to be a for-profit thing? Why are so much money exchanging hands? It must be corrupt. How would you address that?
Well, it's you know, people don't work for free. So, you know, you do work for the living. I mean, that's okay to be paid.
Let me clarify then. Let me throw the words big pharma into that accusation. And maybe we can take it from that angle as well, because that's usually what we hear. It's profitable for people to have cancer. Therefore, big pharma is keeping the cure for cancer quiet. It's profitable for people to be sick. Therefore, big pharma is keeping the cures for sickness under wraps so it can sell them these sort of symptom-based and expensive medicines. These are the charges I hear.
Which are silly. Obviously, we're a pharmaceutical company able to find a clear cure for what at present is a difficult cancer to treat, then they would be more than happy to market that. So that's not it. But one could reasonably argue that that companies do push products, and this is not vaccines, because vaccines really are just a very small part of the marketplace for healthcare. I mean, vaccines are, I think, a correction error in what is a $2.7 trillion healthcare budget. But you could reasonably argue that often companies will push products that have a very small gain in terms of treating a particular disease as being sort of a panacea when they're not. And certainly companies have acted unethically and aggressively and at times even illegally, for which they've been called to task. My problem is that I think everything, it's always about the data. I mean, what are the data that supports or doesn't support a particular drug? I think it's sort of intellectually lazy to kind of just say all pharmaceutical companies act in that way. All products should be treated with disdain and suspicion, even when the data are clear. It's always the false dichotomy, right? You have parents or patients on one side, and you have pharmaceutical companies on the other. You have doctors on the other. Well, first of all, pharmaceutical companies are made up of people that are parents and patients. The doctors are also parents and patients themselves. Doctors also give vaccines to their own children. So it's a silly dichotomy. It's an unnecessary dichotomy. And I think if I had a fantasy here, it would be that pharmaceutical companies would do a much better job at actually putting a human face to what they do. I worked with Merck for 16 years on what was the development of our vaccine. You know, we created the strains that became the bovine human reassortant rotavirus vaccine, Rotatec, in 2006. But I worked with Merck for the 16 years that they worked with them. I wasn't paid by them, but I certainly worked with them to try and help them with the science that advanced that vaccine, which is, say, the research or development. And I found them to be, you know, hardworking and ethical and wanting to try and do the right thing. I just wish that there was a human face to that. I'll give you an example. When we, you know, we did ultimately was the phase 3 trial, which was a prospective placebo-controlled 72,000 person, 11 country, 4-year trial that probably cost about $350 million to do. When that trial was finished and our vaccine was shown to be safe and effective and had the chance then to reduce all the death that's caused by rotavirus in this world, the woman who was in charge of that was a woman named Penny Heaton, who ran that program, and she stood up in front of this group of 200 people as we broke the code to find out that the vaccine worked, and she showed a map of the world, and on that map there were these black dots in places like Africa and Asia and Latin America, and each black dot represented 1,000 deaths. And then she showed the next slide in which all those black dots were gone, and she said, now we have in hand the technology to prevent all that. And then she put her head down and wept. I don't think anybody has that image of a pharmaceutical company. It's too bad, because they're all different. They all do different things in different ways, and certainly they're not all evil.
And we're not saying they're perfect either. You know, corruption exists wherever human beings exist. You know, greed exists wherever human beings exist. You're going to find the best and worst case scenarios, to be fair.
Of course.
Talking here with Dr. Paul Offit, you mentioned that you were co-inventor of this, is it rotavirus vaccine, Rotatech?
Yes.
Can you tell me just in layman's terms and ways that we can sort of understand what this is and what it does?
Right. So rotavirus is a virus that is ubiquitous. There is not a child in this world that will get to age 5 without having been infected by this virus. Typically, it causes fever and vomiting and diarrhea, most commonly in the 6 to 24-month-old. In this country, prior to the development of availability of the vaccine, our vaccine was available in 2006 and routinely recommended in 2006, every year there would be several million people who would be children who would be infected. There were hundreds of thousands of emergency department visits. There were probably about 70,000 hospitalizations and about 60 deaths a year. In the developing world, there's about 2,000 children that die every day of this virus. It's probably, as a single agent, it's the biggest killer of infants and young children in the world. So we worked for a little over 25 years to develop the strains that became that vaccine, and it's virtually eliminated the disease in this country, and now it's in the process of trying to lessen the burden of disease in the developing world.
We were doing our year-in-review broadcast. We were talking about the fact that measles has been wiped out in the United States thanks to vaccines. And yet, because it is being introduced from external places, of people coming into the country, and then there are those here who are not vaccinating their kids, this all feeds into a reintroduction of measles into a place where measles is supposed to be gone.
Correct. No, you're correct in stating that we eliminated measles in the United States by the year 2000, but unfortunately it's back. We have now low enough immunization rates that every year we see small outbreaks of measles. So it's fear of vaccines. I think that it's not hard to understand. We ask citizens in this country to give their children, about 14 different vaccines to prevent 14 different diseases in the first few years of life, which can mean as many as 26 inoculations during that time. It can mean as many as 5 shots at one time to prevent diseases that most people don't see using biological fluids most people don't understand. So it's not hard to understand why it is that some people fear vaccines for wrong reasons, but they still fear them because they don't fear the disease. I think the bottom line is people just don't fear the disease, so they think they're safe until something like this happens.
Do you think people fear science in some ways? Right? They don't trust science as much as they trust their gut, their intuition. They have a feeling that this is right. But science and scientists, it just seems like the other to them.
No, you're right. It's this sort of postmodern thinking that my attitudes and beliefs are as valid as anybody else's, independent of whether those other people have, scientific evidence or data to support their point of view. I mean, that's Jenny McCarthy. Right? She goes on the Oprah show and she says, I have my science. He's at home and his name is Evan. Even though, her concern that MMR vaccine, or measles, mumps, rubella vaccine caused autism was clearly ill-founded and frankly has been disproved. She just holds on to that belief as one holds on to a religious belief. Which is to say that you hold on to that in the face of evidence that clearly contradicts it.
Let me one final time bounce back into the placebo effect, if I may. Someone goes to a faith healing crusade and they are prayed for and they walk away with a feeling, a euphoric feeling that something really important has happened. I mean, they feel so good, they toss their crutches aside and they can walk. They don't have the labored breathing. They don't feel the pain. This is the placebo effect at play, handed over to them by someone who is claiming divine favor. What's your take on the faith healer?
I'm all for it. I think it's great. To a point. The point is you don't pray instead of giving antibiotics, or don't pray instead of getting chemotherapy, or don't pray instead of getting insulin for your diabetes. I mean, I think I have no problem with that. I have no problem with the chaplain in our hospital who goes from patient to patient. I think it's fine. I just don't think one should substitute that for what is, medical practices that can save your life.
But if it's medical practice that's providing the solution, would it not be better to reject the portion that is not supported for the solution that is?
No, I do think there is something to be said for being euphoric or for believing that this is helping you. I do think that that your attitude matters. This was sort of Norman Cousins' point when he was trying to fight what was unusual rheumatologic disease. He watched, you know, Marx Brothers movies and you know, tried to laugh to put himself in the best possible situation, because he believed that were he to be depressed, to be really down about what was a very serious and chronic condition, that that would make things worse for him. And I think he's probably right. But he didn't eschew then also modern medicine. He still, you know, availed himself of modern medicine while he was also doing these other things. I think that that series of books that he wrote was a contribution. And so I'm fine with it. I am. I just don't think you should substitute one for the other.
I think there's a difference between someone maybe kneeling at the bedside of a family member or friend and engaging in an act of prayer, and someone promising divine favor, magical healing from some invisible other place, usually at the end of an offering plate. This, to me, seems unethical and something that wouldn't be supported by science-based physicians.
No, I agree. If you're talking about faith healing, which is to say that one puts their faith in the divine to heal, that I think is fraud. It's not fair. Oral Roberts, who claims to have performed resurrections, I think that's probably not true either. And so, I think they're in danger of lives. Which would amaze me, and this is why I wrote the book. I mean, Bad Faith, because I'm in Philadelphia, which I feel like is faith healing central. We have two very large faith healing churches in this city, with Faith Tabernacle and First Century Gospel. We have hundreds of children who we know in this city are being prayed for instead of being given antibiotics for their bacterial pneumonia. We recently had two deaths from that in one of these faith healing groups, or given insulin for diabetes or chemotherapy for their cancers. And so are those children suffering? By definition, they're suffering. We know they're suffering, and we do nothing about it out of our quote-unquote respect for religion, out of our feeling that we don't want to tell people not only not how to raise their children, but not how to practice their faith. This to me is not religion. I think that when you put your child in harm's way unnecessarily, to me that's not a religious act, so it shouldn't be given the legal protections of religion. And it just bothers me that there are 44 states that essentially have religious exemptions to child abuse and neglect laws. It's just ridiculous, and we do nothing about it. I mean, the reason I wrote the book, actually, was because I lived through the 1991 Philadelphia measles epidemic, which centered on those two churches that I just mentioned. Think about this past year's measles epidemic. There were 158 cases. About a quarter of those cases were hospitalized, and no children died. Okay, in our city, in the three-month period in early 1991, this is 30 years into the availability of a measles vaccine, we had 1,400 cases and 9 deaths in 3 months in our city. I mean, centering on these two churches, and although they were the epicenter, obviously the virus didn't recognize your religious beliefs and spread, you know, to the surrounding community where it caused suffering and death. And we basically let it happen. I mean, I watched this. I was here then. I was at Children's Hospital then. We let it happen because we didn't want to interfere with how these people were practicing their faith. My attitude at the time was, where was the church? I think these were highly unchristian acts, but they were yet being done in the name of Christ.
Do you think the parents should have been prosecuted in those cases?
Yes, I do. That's exactly what I think. I think that the minute you let your child die of a preventable or treatable infection, I think your children should be put in foster care and you should be put in jail. I think that which is basically what happens in other countries. I mean, this stuff doesn't happen in England. It doesn't happen in Canada. It happens here. It happens here because it can happen here, because there are 44 states, including in our state, that have these religious exemptions of child abuse and neglect. Well, for the most part, you can do that here. And as I talk about in the book, that didn't used to be true. I mean, for the most part, American law follows British law, and we followed British law up until 1972. And that's when their so-called Child Abuse Protection and Treatment Act, or CAPTA, was passed by Richard Nixon. And there were two prominent members of Richard Nixon's staff that were Christian scientists that saw that there was about to be an uncomfortable light shown on their religion with this Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act. And so they insisted that you could not get federal funds unless your state had a religious exemption to child abuse and neglect laws, including medical neglect. And those two prominent Christian scientists were Bob Halderman, who was Nixon's chief of staff, and John Ehrlichman, who was his chief domestic policy advisor.
The book was selected by the New York Times as an editor's choice in 2015. It's called Bad Faith, When Religious Belief Undermines Modern Medicine. I'm going to link this book in the description box of this broadcast in case you'd like to pick up a copy, which I have, and check it out for yourself. Dr. Paul Offit, thanks so much for your time, for your inside expertise, and for your great work over there in Philadelphia. And thanks for being a part of this broadcast. It means a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to the broadcast tonight. I'll see you back here on Tuesday of next week as we talk about the Ark Encounter. What is this monstrosity they're building in Kentucky? And what's been going on behind the scenes to get it built? We'll talk about it next Tuesday night. Have a great week. I'll see you soon.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.